Welcome then to the run-ins, the games with Rob and Rachel as we build up to Paris 2024. We're going to have a look at some of the great archive from Trans World Sport history. He's getting excited about this one, as am I. We're looking at the greatest female Olympians of all time. We would start with track and field if we're allowed. We're not. We're going to start with gymnastics.
We are. And you know, one of the things that is so amazing about the Olympic Games, we are talking about superheroes, men and women, who have scaled heights nobody ever thought was possible. And I think the Olympic Games is for all children everywhere. And we can't possibly touch on every great female Olympian over the course of this episode, because otherwise we'd be here for 6 hours. But if there's anything that sparks someone's imagination, if they're watching or listening to this, if they've got a niece or a daughter and they think, actually, my little girl will be interested in that, just have a go, because all the great women we're about to talk about at some point watched or heard about another woman in the Olympics and looked at them and thought, that one day might be me. So it's really exciting. And I honestly think the Olympics is for the children, and children need to be inspired. And so many people were inspired, men, women and children, by Nadia Comaneci. Now, the perfect 10, uneven bars, 1976. Not even the scoreboard had been set up for a 10.0. And yet that Romanian lit up the games in Canada in 76 in a way that perhaps a sport other than gymnastics wouldn't have been able to do. It was an iconic moment of global sport, and it happened to Comaneci in 76. It was wonderful.
Well, she went on to achieve 5 golds, 3 silvers and 2 bronze at 76 and the 80 Olympic Games. And of course, us lot here at Trans World Sport, we caught up with her to talk about her glittering career.
I didn't expect to get a 10. I didn't realize that we'll be the first 10 in the history. And because in that moment I was thinking what my family will say when they will see that. I didn't realize the real value of the medals. I mean, I started gymnastics at 6 years old, and I retired in 84. In 84 I was 23. There were lots of years that I spent my time in a gym, and that was a really hard work. When I watched the medals, that's what I did in my life, so I'm proud about that.
Comaneci, an absolutely legendary figure of Olympic gymnastics and the toast of Romania. And I think, Rach, I was sort of trying to get my head around this because I primarily come from a track and field background. To fully understand what Comaneci achieved, we have to go through the stages of how female gymnastics went through the gears in terms of providing incredible women to keep on continually raising the standards and raising the profile. There was a woman called Vera Kozlowska who competed. She was a 22-year-old secretary from Prague. She competed in 64 and 68, and she was a massive figure, partly fueled by the fact that she married a very famous, brilliant 1500-meter runner who got the silver in 64, Josef Odlazil. So they were like a mega couple in the Czech Republic. Fast forward to Mexico in 68. She did her floor exercises to the Mexican hat dance song.
I don't even know how that goes.
Her name was being chanted all around the stadium. So suddenly female gymnastics in the late 60s, in as far as the Olympic stories were concerned, were huge. Fast forward from her exploits to Olga Korbut, the Munchkin from Munich, just 4'11", 17 years of age. The Germans fell in love with Korbut. They just couldn't get enough of her, because sometimes she got it right and sometimes she got it wrong. And she wore her heart on her sleeve and had no idea at all. Gold on the balance beam and the floor. She got a silver in the beam in 76. She had no idea what a big star she had become until she went home and she was getting 20,000 letters from across the world every year for the first few years after getting back from Munich. And to the point where the local postal service had to assign a postal worker just to deal with her post alone. So that gives you the background to Comaneci and why the perfect 10 was so important, because you had these incredible women at every games raising the bar and raising the standards again and again and again. So that package of female gymnasts in the 60s and 70s, they elevated gymnastics to a level that we'd never seen before. It was a very, very special time.
And you're probably going to talk about gymnastics as well as being a sport where the women definitely outshine the men. And that's probably because of the beauty that I feel like surrounds gymnastics, the poise, the glamour, the outfits that they wear. It's much more, isn't it, than possibly just the sport. They put a lot of time into their makeup. It's a very feminine sport. You can't not talk about gymnastics and not talk about Simone Biles. I mean, her story, she's still only 27, I think it is. And if you know anything about Simone Biles, again, she's actually retired recently. She took a step back, I should say, from sport without saying retiring. She is coming back. She's actually had an award for comeback in 24. In 23, she actually won 4 World Championship gold medals on the way to coming back to the Olympic Games. She's won 7 Olympic medals, and that was from Rio in Tokyo. I guess the big story about Simone Biles was, though, in Tokyo. I'm not sure if you were across gymnastics totally, but she had something called the twisties. It's a kind of vertigo condition that when you're in the air doing these kind of twists and turns that you do, your body doesn't quite know what you're doing, and it can be very dangerous in the sport of gymnastics. So she took a step back. She did actually win a silver in the team event, and then she came on to win a bronze as well individually at the end of the games. But after that, she said it really affected her mental health. So she's had a bit of a hiatus from gymnastics, and she is coming back, hopefully in Paris, to try and kind of cement her status as one of the best gymnastics. And when asked why she was going to come back, she said, I don't want to look 10 years down the line and say, what else could I have done? You know, she retired on the top. Okay, she had this thing called the twisties. But if you're that good, Rob, you surely want to come back and just prove a point and say, you know, I've still got it. And she seems to have done that in the World Championships last year.
It was very interesting following it from afar, because obviously once the athletics starts, you're just buried in statistics
so
the whole time.
For those who haven't been to a Games, it's so hard to try and keep up with every sport, isn't it?
Well, especially something like athletics, where there's so many events happening every day with hundreds and hundreds of people coming across your radar in terms of commentary. But following the headlines, I thought what was quite interesting about Biles, as a non-gymnastics expert, there was so much positive publicity around her honesty. I almost think she got as much publicity from the way she handled her difficulties as she had done for previous gold medals.
And just how big she is as well. I was having a quick look. I love to look at their socials and see what kind of status they have in terms of superstar status. 7.1 million people follow Simone Biles as a gymnast, which I think a couple of years ago would have been unheard of. And she's done that not just on the gymnastic mats in the gymnastic arena, but by being so much more. And she is an advocate now for mental health as well, which is so important, not just in sport, but in our everyday lives.
And I think what's quite interesting about looking at the greatest female Olympians, there are a lot of sports now almost going as far as positive discrimination, because they're rightly trying to redress imbalances in profile, in prize money, and in the perceived prestige of female success as opposed to male. I think there's a strong case for saying that the Olympic platform has always tried to be as equal as possible, because...
Well, it is this year. For the first time ever, we've got gender parity in the Games. First time ever.
But even I'm not talking about specific numbers of females and males. I'm talking about what profile and what platform were those who were there given. And the fact that we've talked about Comaneci from 76, the fact that we're talking about Biles, I think there are certain sports who've gone out of their way to make sure that the prize money has been equal, that the profile of their stars has been equal. And when I'm commentating or watching an Olympic contest, I don't notice whether I'm watching a male competition or a female competition. I'm simply looking at what a brilliant story it is. Whether they're male or female is irrelevant. And that's how it should be. And I think in that regards, there are some Olympic sports that are miles ahead in terms of the parity of profile given to the men and the women. And the gymnastics is a great example of that.
That is so interesting. When I tune in for something like the athletics, I don't care if it's the men's or women's event. I watch every single one, regardless of gender.
Of course. And your excitement is tailored to the personality of the individual. If in a certain Olympic cycle, there are more engaging stories with the female athletes, they take priority. Now, if we're talking about equal platform, the Australians are so proud of their swimming heritage, and they're every bit as proud of their female swimming heritage as their male. Shane Gould, unbelievable. 12 races, 8 days, 3 golds, 1 silver, 1 bronze, and then retired at 16 after 1972. Absolutely phenomenal. And probably going back before Shane Gould, Dawn Fraser. I think there's a case that Dawn Fraser...
He's scratching his head, guys, if you can't see. Because... That means he's got a big case to put out.
Oh,
because come on, set the stall out.
Listen.
I'm listening. Everyone's listening.
We have spoken in some of our previous episodes. We touched on great male Olympians. And I made the point that it wasn't just what they did, it was how they did it. There is no better example of that than Dawn Fraser. We could do 25 minutes on Dawn Fraser alone. Because how about this? Dawn Fraser, the first male or female swimmer to win the freestyle, the 100 freestyle, 3 times in a row, 56, 60 and 64. When she won it in 56, I mean, it's about the story that goes along with the athlete. When she won it in 56, she somehow found a ladder and climbed up into the stands to celebrate with her parents in memory of her brother Don, who had introduced her to swimming and had passed away. In 1960, when she successfully defended the title, she caused massive controversy within the Australian team. I didn't know this.
Did she get a rope then and she lassoed it up to...
She refused to do a relay leg with her teammates. And they did that thing, they call it sent her to Coventry. They were ignoring her because she'd fallen out with the Australian authorities and had successfully defended her title and then that was it. Then she had a car crash in February 64. Devastating. She was driving. Her mother was killed. She chipped a vertebrae. Bearing in mind, this is five or six months before she tries for the unprecedented third in a row. She spent 6 weeks with her neck in plaster. Won the third in a row. Then ended up getting... I mean, honestly, this is why hasn't this been made into a film? She was arrested because she shimmied up a flagpole at the Emperor's palace to nick a flag. In the end, the Japanese authorities in Tokyo and the Australians got together and felt that she was this legendary figure. So they arranged for her to be given a flag instead of the one she nicked to restore peace and order. Dawn Fraser is an absolutely incredible, iconic figure. What an example in terms of, I'm going to live my life the way I want to. I'm going to be me, and I don't care what you say about it. I'm just going to go out, and I did it my way. And there's no better example of that than Dawn Fraser. If there's young girls looking for spirited examples of those to follow from the past, Fraser is at the top of the pile. But listen, we could go on and on and on. We do have to talk about other great female swimmers. And how about this? Christina Egasegi, the first male or female swimmer to win five individual gold medals, because her era came before Michael Phelps. And we caught up with her in 94. Brilliant backstroker, brilliant medley relay swimmer. We caught up with her ahead of her training for her final games.
A lot of parents have been afraid to encourage their children to become swimmers because they're worried that they'll become big and muscle-bound. But with the right kind of training, this doesn't have to be the case. World records and gold medals go together, but the records are more important because that's how people write themselves into the history books. I think that this is especially true if the record is not broken for a long time.
Rob, I think, could talk about swimming until the cows come home here. There's so many stories of the swimming pool. But Rob, we're going to move on to the track as well and talk about the Flying Dutchwoman, Fanny Blankers-Cohen, from the 1948 Games. Straight away after the war as well, she created a little bit of history, becoming the first woman to win four gold medals on the track in the 100 metres, the 200 metres, 4x100 metres, and she also popped over the 80 metre hurdles as well. We caught up with her in 1991.
They didn't really like me winning the 100 metres, since a silver medal went to a British athlete. The same happened when I won the 80 metre hurdles. But by the time we ran the 200 metres, they had become very enthusiastic indeed. And each one of them was incredibly nice and pleasant. I could have won if I'd participated. But anyway, it's always easy to talk about these things afterwards. I was really sorry about missing the long jump, but I didn't really mind not taking part in the high jump, because I never really liked that event.
I just love that. Blankers-Cohen, you've got to be good to say, yeah, I didn't really mind not doing a high jump and missing out. But the full story with Blankers-Cohen is absolutely incredible, because she actually competed as an 18-year-old in the high jump in 1936. She didn't get a medal, but by the time 1940, and this is important, we're talking about great women, and in that era, it's the stereotypes that they overcame to succeed. So by 1948, Blankers-Cohen was 30. At that time, for men, for male track athletes as well, that would have been considered old at that time, as was she. And people said, she's too old to win medals. She's too old to get on the podium. She's a housewife. She's got two kids. Yes, she was married, and yes, she had two children. But boy, oh boy, was she ready to prove them wrong, that she was too old. When she returned, I think this parade happened in Amsterdam or her hometown, I can't remember which, there was a massive open carriage tour through the town or city with four perfectly decorated grey horses. And she was heralded as a great, great heroine, which she was. And she even went on to compete in 1952. She didn't manage to win a medal in Helsinki. You know, that was a great Games dominated by the likes of Emil Zatopek winning the 5 and the 10 and the marathon. But Blankers-Cohen is a key cornerstone of female sport, because she was able to succeed into her 30s. She was able to succeed as a married mother of two. And she didn't just win those races. She absolutely decimated world-class fields at an age where people thought that she was far, far too old. So there's her contribution to history, and any young sportswoman anywhere in the world should look up the story of Fanny Blankers-Cohen for everything she did away from the track and how she proved people wrong. So that's that era.
Can I just jump in on how archaic something, what you said there, the fact that she was a housewife and a mother, because this year, I don't know if you know this year as well, in the Olympic Village, they have a creche and the ability for mothers to have a breastfeeding area. They are really kind of going up a notch in terms of looking after mothers who are now competing, which was never done in the past. So I think what they're trying to do, they're trying to make it inclusive so you can have a safe space as a competing athlete, as a mother, to kind of go to the Olympic Village, and there's somewhere for your kids. There's someone to look after your kids. You don't have to think, well, am I being looked after if I bring my children here? Which I think is brilliant.
Yes, and the performances of people like Fanny Blankers-Cohen was the first step in a long, long road. So there's the Dutch female contribution to greatness as far as athletics is concerned. And as far as sprinting is concerned, even though she's a brilliant high jumper and long jumper as well, fast forward to the modern era, and there are just so many incredible examples of phenomenal American and Jamaican and further Caribbean female athletes who've catapulted sprinting to a higher level.
I don't know who you've gone for. I kind of put a list and we can actually tick off and see if we've got the same ones.
Okay.
Did you put Sanya Richards-Ross down?
Funnily enough, I didn't. And only because I think I was focusing on multiple gold medalists, okay, because I thought the list was so tight. If you're not familiar with Sanya Richards-Ross, absolutely incredible. She was expected to win the gold in Beijing in 2008 for the United States. I believe she was born in Jamaica and emigrated to the States. She's a fantastic woman.
So she takes both boxes, it's fine.
She's a fantastic woman. And then ended up beating Christina Hurugu and finally getting her Olympic gold to go alongside
That's
a world
why,
gold
your heart was
in
broken.
London
okay.
in 2012.
Elaine Thompson-Herath.
Oh, unbelievable. She's done the double-double and has always found herself injured. So she's done the one and the two in Rio and in Tokyo with awful, awful Achilles injuries and hamstring injuries in between those two times. If she could get anywhere close to good form, she knows that she peaks for the Olympic years. She's absolutely.
So she was on yours?
She's absolutely Shelley in the conversation.
Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce?
Oh, listen, you go.
Was she on your list? I don't know who was on. I'm trying to tick off and you're not even going ticking off with me.
How can she not be?
You go
on why you...
That was my top four, basically.
Yes, yeah, same.
Okay, fine. We agreed on something,
right,
guys.
You go on why Fraser-Pryce is amazing and I'll back you up and I'll state
well,
the case
she,
for divas.
But the fact that she can go back-to-back. I think if anyone can go back-to-back and do it over the course of two Olympic cycles, you've got to have the case for the greatest of all time. That's the thing, what you put it down to, if you can go back-to-back and do it not just once, twice as well.
Yes, so we're talking about Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce winning in Beijing in 08, winning in London in 12, bronze in 16, silver in Tokyo. Yeah. Here's a question for you then, Stringer. This is big. If Fraser-Pryce wins, it's almost like a drum roll here.
Is she better than...
If she wins a medal of any colour for five in a row in the 100 metres, does she become the greatest Olympic 100 metre runner in history, male or female? I'm starting to get towards thinking that a medal of any colour, five in a row with two golds,
and
there's a strong case for that surpassing Bolt's 300s in a row.
I love that. You have to add a kid in there. I remember I've got a picture, actually, with her. She's got her child on her hip. She came up, I think it was the World Champs in 2019, to where I was standing doing the interviews with her child on her hip and delivered the interview like that. I know it wasn't Olympic Games, but it was still absolutely iconic in my opinion because she'd done all of that as well as having a child. I guess that I'm putting something else in the context there. Has she done as much for the sport as someone like Usain Bolt? Question mark. Rob is lost for words.
No, I'm waiting.
Oh,
yes, right.
But,
if she wins,
I don't
listen,
think
listen.
She has.
If she wins a medal, I'm just putting it out there. If she wins a medal of any colour for five successive 100 metre Olympic medals
on the track, what has she done to maybe better?
Bigger than Bolt? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
Bolt isn't just an athlete.
Yes.
Bolt is a superstar.
Yeah.
Globally, when Bolt was competing, he still obviously holds the records in one and two. Globally, though, when Bolt was competing, he couldn't probably walk anywhere or a lot of places around the world and not be recognised.
Yep.
Can Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce do that? I'm sure she can. I'm sure not many people. I know she's iconic. She's always got crazy coloured hair and whatever her style is. She's very flamboyant. Do you think a lot of people would stop her on the street and ask now for a selfie, not an autograph? I don't still think she's that recognisable.
Okay, yeah, not listen.
So
it's interesting. I just can't believe
greatest...
the longevity. If she
you know
gets
what I mean?
A medal,
that's
of any
how
colour.
You look
yeah,
at
yeah.
a superstar.
Yeah, okay.
Phelps is the same as a Bolt.
And listen, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a partly rhetorical question, and I consider it an utter privilege to have been in those stadiums watching Bolt win so many of those golds. I just think. For someone to go five in a row, if she can win a fifth successive medal, would be fascinating. Okay, so one other, you touched quite rightly on Gail Devers. I think, again, it's what Devers, Gail Devers is one of, I think, only two women to go, maybe three now, to go back to back one, or she was the second. Elaine Thompson-Herath became the third with 16 and 21 over the 100s. But Gail Devers was only the second woman to go back-to-back Olympic 100-metre titles in her second best event. Because try as she might, it always went wrong in the sprint hurdles.
And it's also the problems that she had as well.
Oh, huge.
Full of the best health, the autoimmune diseases, and
yes.
She had a couple of problems that she was also trying to deal with.
Yes, between so she reached the semis, I believe, of the 100 hurdles in 88. Then she had that terrible autoimmune illness. I'm not even sure. I can't remember reading somewhere. There might even have been a possibility at one stage that they were talking about an amputation. Her injuries and her illness was so bad. So to then come back and win the iconic race, the 100 metres, back to back.
But they were so tight. They were so tight as well. Do you remember all the photo finishes that she's been a part of? So it was always kind of waiting, bated breath. Have I done it? Again, look at those pictures, because they were as close as you like in both of her races, both of her golds. It wasn't just one.
No, I know.
But it was contested in both of them.
What she did. Absolutely incredible.
But I think the greats do that as well. They know how to just get over the line. And Michael Phelps spoke about that. He said, I never was not going to win if it came down to a photo finish, because I knew how to put my hand forward and just get in the right position. And I'm sure Gail Devers was an athlete who just did that. You know how to finish if you're an Olympic champion, if you're one of the greatest. We didn't mention someone else, Rob. Alison Felix.
Yep.
Stunning, beautiful, incredible. Ugh, she's just full of poise, full of grace when she runs.
Grace, that's the word I think of always,
I'm just picturing her running now at 200 metres. So fluid, so effortless. And obviously she achieved that, didn't she, at London in 2012. She achieved so many medals, Olympic medals. One of the greatest track and field USA athletes of all time. I mean,
global of all time.
7 golds, 3 silvers and a bronze there.
And you could just talk about Alison Felix all day. In fact, one of my great moments was having the privilege of commentating on her last appearance for the United States in Eugene on home soil in 2022. An amazing woman. So at what stage of this great journey did Transworld Sport choose to catch up with Alison Felix a month into her retirement? Where did they even start? What questions did they ask? Here's what she had to say.
Relays are so much fun, and it's great to be a part of a team effort, but there's really something about doing it by yourself and just the years of hard work and sacrifice that, you know, when it finally comes together, it's definitely a different feeling. I think I love to go fast. You know, I'm a sprinter. I've always, you know, loved the 100, loved the 200, and really loved that technique of it. And the 400 is such a strategy race. You know, it's a race you have to be patient, you have to trust your fitness, your endurance, and it's just a completely different beast. And so I think that, you know, I love the challenge of it. I love to see if I can put it all together, but it's not like the sprints at all for me.
Alison Felix, just a truly iconic figure. What an absolute privilege for Transworld Sport to catch up with her. Now, from one world-class 400-metre runner to another, we've been talking a lot on this podcast, whatever you want to call it, about greats coping with pressure. And when it comes to sprinting in the Olympic Games, there could surely not have been any greater pressure than that placed upon Cathy Freeman, representing Australia, representing the Aborigine community, in the final of the 400 metres in Sydney. Remember, she'd won the world title in 97. She'd won the world title in 99. She'd picked up the silver in the Olympics in Atlanta. But there was only one outcome and one colour that the Australian public were expecting from her come Sydney. Transworld Sport caught up with her in the lead-up to a race and a night that would define her and an entire nation.
It's really important for them to see that I'm just exactly like them. I mean, I run fast, but the only difference is that I've had the right support around me, and I know, I realise the value of hard work and being, you know, of persevering and being determined and always, you know, being positive and just realising that I can be somebody, that I can make the most of who I am. It would mean something unbelievable if I was to win. It would mean, it would be a dream come true, you know. It wouldn't mean absolutely everything to me, but it would mean a real lot to me. It would mean that probably make me cry, and not a running usually doesn't have that effect on me, you know, because it's only running, it's only sport. But yeah, so. It would mean a lot to me.
Well, it wouldn't just mean a lot to her, would it, Rob? It meant a lot to an entire country, like you said, an entire community. It was just how she did it. In the build-up, there was one point when she was kind of trying, people were trying to deter her from even competing. They said she should boycott it, shouldn't they, at the time, and say, you know, don't even go for it. She said, well, I'm about running. If I can't run, then the Australians have taken that away from me as well. She was talking about, obviously, her Aboriginal roots there, and said, I don't want to have that taken away from me, because there is a lot of history to this story as well, which I don't know how much we should to get into that. There's a lost generation in Australia. A lot of Aboriginal children were taken away from their parents. This was a number of years ago now, before Cathy Freeman's victory, but she said her grandparents are part of that generation. So she felt like it was her duty to give back to the community, which had lost so much in the past. And she did that evening in just spectacular fashion. And for me, when I've rewatched that as well, it's how she did it. It's that suit that she wore, and she looks that suit. She had a hood up, didn't she, when she was running? She said she'd done that before, and she felt like the reason it worked for her is she can be in the bubble, and she needed to be in that bubble in that race, because there were so many distractions that could have got to her. And for some reason or another, it came right on the day. And it's probably that, the greatest story, how she could do what she did under such immense pressure. And you mentioned as well that she had given the opportunity, it was a bit of a contested subject, that she was allowed to go and light the flame in the iconic white suit. That was she made to wear that?
I can't remember. I don't know about the colours of the suit. But
you know, you must remember that iconic. She was in that all one white tight lycra suit to light the flame.
I remember her lighting the flame, not what she was wearing. But I just...
As a woman, she remembers things like that, Rob.
The whole build-up to that final, I'm not sure, because she was flying the flag. And I think, yeah, of course, there's a massive history there. And it's a history that you and I are not qualified to give full comment on. But what we can say is that when Cathy Freeman raced and won, she waved Australian flags and she waved Aboriginal flags.
Which was all that she was told not to do, remember, as well.
But she had got to a point where she was literally and metaphorically waving the flag for both. So that was the way she was going to represent her nation and her heritage. Brilliant. But the pressure, more than I think, I'm struggling to think of any other host nation favourite experiencing a more pressured environment than that. Sydney was a return to the good old days for the Olympics, I think. There were one or two people I remember. I know you were young at the time, but maybe you weren't even born. 96? I can't remember that. But you would have just been a toddler if. So in 96, there was a strong feeling that the Olympics should have gone to Athens, because it would have been the centenary, 1896 being the first Games. And I think there was a feeling that money had swayed that decision the way of Atlanta. By Sydney, you just got an incredible, incredible sporting festival. I think Sydney was the greatest Games until London. And I don't say that because I'm British. It just, London again catapulted the Games to a higher level. It was so pure in Sydney. And Cathy was at the very heartbeat of that. Lighting the flame, getting to the final. There were 112,000 people in that stadium that night. That became, I think this is the case, that it is or was at the time the third most watched moment in Australian history. The only two with bigger viewing figures, Princess Diana's funeral and the opening ceremony at Sydney. It was very close behind that. Half the population of the nation who were cognizant and of an age to realise what they were watching, tuned in. And it was funny, that's the last Games I watched as a fan before I then went to Athens and every Games onwards. I got a very strong feeling the second she crossed the finish line, I remember thinking to myself, she'll never be the same person again. She's never going to run as well as this again, because to have done this has taken something out of her that cannot be put back in. And she alone will know the toll of carrying that expectation took on her body and on her you know, the psychology. It's a bit like there's a theory with marathon runners, men and women, that it takes them to such a pain barrier that every marathon they run takes something out of them that no amount of rest and recovery can put back in. I think it was one of the greatest handful of Olympic performances we've ever seen going back to 1896. It was truly extraordinary.
Is that a highlight for you as well? A personal highlight from your memories of Olympic Games?
Yes, because of the pressure. Absolutely unbelievable what she achieved and what she has continued to achieve for her community, for her heritage and for her country. Unbelievable woman.
I don't really know how to top that. I don't really know where to go from that. I do, because it puts an end to what we like to call the sprints. And actually, we have a question, won't we? Is 400 metre sprint? Yes, absolutely it is. That comes under that category. We've spoken about sprints a lot. We'll go to middle distance, longer distances, shall we? And you've got to talk about a nation of domination as well, the Africans, and in particular, Ethiopia. And I'm sure you'd have commentated, actually, Deratatulu, I'm sure, a number of times, but what she did in the 10,000 metres, not winning gold once, as she did in 92. She went and did it again, didn't she, in Sydney as well. And actually, we actually caught up with her here on Transosport in 1998, just 2 years before she got a second gold.
At school, I didn't really take running seriously. I just ran like all my other classmates. But as I got better, I began to take it more seriously. And I began to learn about the history of our country's famous runners,
like Abebe Bikila, Mama World, and Mertes Yifta. And that encouraged me to want to exceed in athletics.
When I started, I had cultural obstacles. And coming from the rural areas, it made the obstacles more glaring. Even at home, I had problems with my mother. She didn't believe that a woman should be running. That should be left to a man. But with the encouragement of my sisters and friends, I continued. When I started to win, my mother then began to support me.
I'm proud to win and win for women. But to be called the mother of Ethiopian athletics is too high of an accolade. Sure, a lot of women picked up athletics because of me, and some of them are marching towards big futures in our sport. But the mother of our sports, men and women, is our country, Ethiopia.
Our Deratatulu is such an important figure for African distance running as well as Ethiopian distance running, and she did go on to win her second gold in Sydney, and which lots of people forget to mention, she then also got a bronze in 2004 in Athens. So she's won three medals spanning four games and only just missed out on the podium in 96 when she was fourth in the 10,000. A massive figure. And I think what's important about Tulu, she began to change the way women were regarded in Ethiopia. And there's a wider little history lesson here. I know you'll be aware of some of this, but a lot of people tuning in won't be, and this is quite important. There was a massive gap where distance events, or even middle distance events, were taken out of the women's programme. The reason it happened, obviously it was incorrect. The reason it happened in the Amsterdam Olympics, and bear with me because this is important, in the Amsterdam Olympics in 1928, there was a women's 800 metres. Now, you know, you've run the 800 to a very high standard. PB 2 seconds quicker than mine. You're never going to let me forget that.
A couple of PBs quicker than his.
Never going to let me forget that. Anyway, you know how much lactic acid can take hold at the end of an 800 metres. That is in no way a reflection of whether you are physiologically adept at running. It just sometimes you get lactic acid, your legs go to jelly and you collapse at the finish line. A couple of women collapsed at the end of the 800. At that time, it was incorrectly deduced that women were not physically capable of running anywhere close to that distance. And that is why, from Amsterdam in 28, you did not see another event over 400 metres until the 800 was reintroduced for women in Rome in 1960. And then from an interest point of view, there were then some brilliant duels. Anne Packer won in 64 for Great Britain. She was a 400 metre runner, but it began to sort of catapult. Then comes back the 1500, the 3000 metres. And very quickly, the powers that be realised, as soon as the 800 came back for women in 60, women were more than capable of competing in all the other events. So that shows you how long the journey has been. And now some of the great finishes are in the women's 5,000, 10,000. And look at what Faith Kipyegon, the Kenyan, has done. You know, she's been absolutely unbelievable in the 1500. You know, she's won two back to back. So Tulu coming along was an important staging post for African and Ethiopian female distance running, but also it just highlighted how much we desperately needed a 10,000 in the Olympic program for women, because the first one was 88 and then her first gold came in 92. So fascinating history, it really is. And long, you know, it should never have gone out in 28, but it did, but it's back. Now, we've talked about the mercurial majesty of women winning fives and 10,000s and marathons. There's also a lot to be admired for the heptathlon, isn't there? I mean, that is a savage two-day test, and only the best will rise to the fore, and they have done on numerous occasions.
Yeah, you talk about winning Olympic gold not once but twice. Imagine, Rob, like you just said, doing it in seven events as well, and imagine trying to retain a title in the heptathlon. You've got to compete in seven events, you've got to train in seven events, you've got to try and avoid injury, and it's only been done twice in Olympic history. In 88 and 92, Jackie Joyner-Kersee did it, and then the Belgium Naffi Thiam has done it more recently in 2016 and 2020 as well. She's still only very young, in her 20s. She has the ability to go and do it again. We caught up with her, though, when she was only 19 years of age, after she'd got one title and was yet to get the second.
In my very first competition, I won some jars of jam. I loved jam at the time, so I wanted to compete again and again to win even more. I never got that prize again, but I still carried on with my running. Heptathlon was a natural choice for me, as I've always competed in all disciplines. I was never outstanding in one particular event, but I was good at all of them. Ever since I was little, I competed in every kind of athletics event. It's just something that I've always done. I've never focused on just one thing. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. Of course, the Olympics are the goal for any athlete, and to win a gold medal is the ultimate dream. But only a few can achieve it. So for me to say yes, I can do this, would be a bit presumptuous, I think.
Well, can Naffi Thiam do it a third in a row as well? That's the big question, isn't it, from London. Can she do it? It would be incredible. First time it's ever happened. Let's not dwell on heptathlon. Let's go to hammer as well. Anita Wladarczyk is someone that I want to speak about, a Polish athlete. She was the first woman ever to throw over 80 metres. Can't really comprehend that as well. She's going for her fourth consecutive gold medal in the hammer in Paris. She's now 38 years old, veteran, pretty much a veteran in terms of any sport, not just hammer.
Yes.
She would be 39 as well. So she turns 39 in August during the game. She turns 39 on the 8th of August. The hammer throw is scheduled for the 6th of August as well. So the fact that she could do that and be a 39-year-old woman winning that. And the story goes as well, Rob, the fact that she's had a bit of an up and down in her career. It was a couple of years ago when, you know, she was going for another world title as well, that she was in the gym and she had a feeling that something negative was going on outside to my car. Random, if you get a feeling like that. She walked out of the gym and someone was breaking into her car and she saw them. She started running after them, got away. She said, if I'd have got hold of them, don't know what would have happened. But in the process, she tore a muscle, went for an MRI scan, realised she'd got quite a severe injury from trying to protect her car. Must have been a good car. Don't know what car it was. Has gone on to recover, now going for the fourth gold. And she said she's never been to Paris before. I can't quite believe that, considering all the athletics meets go around the world and they do go to Paris.
And how long she's been around as well.
Never been to Paris. If she was to go there, it'd be the first time going to Paris, and to defend there would be a little bit of a fairy tale, possibly end to her career. But she said, yeah, I'm going to turn 39 in the games, But she said, as long as I can do this and as long as I enjoy doing this, I will continue to do it.
Oh, she's an absolute machine.
Imagine being 40.
Well, I can. Sadly, it's nearly 10 years ago.
I was going to say.
But not with an Olympic hat full of medals.
Finish the sentence. 40 and winning a gold medal if she was to do that in LA.
Well, I'm going to remember. Well, surely she wouldn't keep going for LA. But
why
let's,
not?
Let's focus
she's
on,
enjoying it.
Hey, listen, let's focus on Paris first. That would be a great achievement. I'm now going to make a mental note that she's going to be 39 2 days after the final. It's an extra little commentator's nugget. You might even get a name check on air for that one, Stringer. Listen, Vladarczyk is fantastic. We could talk about so many great female Olympians, and we are just scratching the surface. If there's someone you're really keen on and we haven't mentioned them, we do apologise. We are literally just opening Pandora's box and seeing what comes out. Should mention Ilonda Balas, the Romanian, fifth, unbelievable high jumper, worth looking up online, her record. Fifth in Melbourne in 56. And then 140. This is ridiculous. 140 consecutive victories, 14 world records. The first woman over 6 foot jumping. She won the title in Rome by 14 centimetres and then successfully defended the crown in Tokyo with a victory by 10 centimetres. These are gigantic winning margins. An absolutely legendary figure from field event athletics from the Olympics. Françoise Etienne, the Cameroonian triple jumper, gold in 04 and 08, fell out with her national federation in between. Really important figure. Yelena Isinbayeva, pole vault gold in 04 and 08. She won in 08, successfully defending her crown with what was her 24th world record. She got to a stage where she was almost bored. There was no competition to push her close. Amazing, amazing females from athletics. If we're casting the net wider, it would be remiss of us not to mention Great Britain's Laura Kenny. 5 golds and a silver across 3 different editions of the Games. She even tried to mount a comeback post-maternity leave for Paris, but felt that, you know, it was a bridge and a step too far. Incredible, incredible women.
And we've got to mention someone that I know, if you're listening, you can't see this, but there's a picture over Rob's shoulder as well of a maybe a well-known tennis player. Oh, he's put his glasses on for this, guys, as well.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So Serena Williams is on a picture alongside Venus Williams there with gold medals. That's because, and I love this, because in tennis, obviously, we have the 4 Grand Slams and, you know, that is something that everybody in tennis wants to win. I feel tennis players puts the Olympic Games as that 5th slam when it comes around, once every 4 years, and they go then, don't they, for the Golden Slam, trying to win all 5. Well, Serena Williams did do that when she finally got her individual gold medal in London 2012. But before that, she won not one, but 3 double gold medals with her sister. That was in Sydney. She missed Athens because if she'd have gone there, they said she might have made an injury she had at the time a little bit worse. Then went to Beijing and got the a double again with Venus then. And then got it in London, the double and the single title. But the fact that she put so much emphasis on the Olympic Games, she didn't need to. You know, she won everything there was to win. But she was one of those athletes that got the Golden Slam, which, if you know Serena Williams, she wants to win everything going. She has won everything going. And I feel that's something that she looks back on with such fond memories. And she says, why would I not want to go to the Olympics and compete with my sister? She goes, if you've competed with Venus, you know how much fun I'm having. And they always looked like they had so much fun. So I love that tennis players really put an emphasis on the Olympics. And we'll see that again this year, not just in the women's side of thing, but the men as well. They all love it. They all want to win it. And most of the greats in the game, like Serena, have won Olympic gold as well.
And that goes to show why tennis deserves to be back in the Olympics. Because when it was first reintroduced, there were a few Olympic aficionados and traditionalists who said, hang on a minute, these male and female tennis players are already multi-millionaires.
It's not about that.
A sport shouldn't be in the games if becoming the Olympic champion isn't the be-all and end-all. And I think whilst it wouldn't eclipse the 4 Grand Slams, it is certainly at least equal to it. And guess what? Transworld Sport, of course, had the opportunity to catch up with Serena. What an iconic figure. And not only those 23 Grand Slams, most importantly of all, from this podcast's perspective, a four-time Olympic champion.
I always said I want to be number one, I want to be the best. And it's the difference between saying it and being it, just doing it all my life. I just expect to at least become a professional tennis player. I think it's important for kids to have a positive role model, and especially me being in a sport that black people predominantly haven't been in much before, and just to be so doing well and have so many kids want to follow, just kids of all races and all colors and all backgrounds. It's really exciting. You know, I haven't had time to actually sit back and think. I think once your career is over, you really realize the changes you've made. But like now, it's like I'm just in the middle of everything and I can't look out too far because I want to stay focused.
It's always such a privilege, isn't it, to hear from Serena, one of the busiest athletes back in the day, obviously retired now. Rob, I mean, there's so many. Again, like you mentioned, we are just scraping the surface. We could go on all day, but I think we had a pretty good list there.
Well, listen, there will be glaring omissions because...
And people won't enjoy that we have left some massive names
out. Yeah, we're talking about history that dates back to 1896. But the most important thing, if you've stuck with us this far, if you know a little girl, if you've got a niece, if you've got a granddaughter, if you've got a daughter, or there's a friend of the family, a goddaughter, if you want them to see something inspirational, tell them to tune in to Paris. However young they are, it's such an important part of what the Olympics is about. It is primarily, in my opinion, for children. It's about young kids, boys and girls. Of course, in this episode, we're talking specifically about female Olympians. It's about young girls looking at great role models on the screen and going, one day that is going to be me. So make sure that the youngsters in your life get to watch the Olympic Games, because you never know what seeds it may begin to water.
Yeah, it's going to be an inspiring couple of weeks. And we're going to be there. I can't wait to be there for working personally on my first Games. Well, that's it from the greatest female Olympic athletes of all time. We could have gone on all day, but I think we had a pretty good list there, Rob. Can't wait, though, for the next episode. We are going to delve into some of the greatest stories from the Olympic Games in our Human Interest episode, which is coming on the next podcast. We'll see you there.